Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
We're set up for a period of time. If they do not pull this off with perfection, the damage that it's going to do to people who think that they have generational wealth is going to be absolutely horrific.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Finance U. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and back with me today is Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Hey, Paul, how are you?
Hi, Chris. I'm doing well. Such an honor to have a chance to talk with you again today.
Likewise. It's looking very festive in the background today. Like the look.
Oh, Renee gets so excited around Christmas time. I mean, we've got, we look like Santa Claus's place here at the office, and it's so funny because clients love it. They seem to.
That's wonderful. Today, we're going to talk about silver and gold. Got to talk about that. Unemployment, because there's a lot of questionable sort of data coming in now, as we've been discussing, but it looks firm at this point. The AI bubble, it's in trouble. We got a lot of interesting story about that. And I want to talk about what I think is oil's bull case. And oil obviously doing really weak right now. So this is like a great time for contrarian people to say, what's happening here? There's a whole story of a surplus and a glut and all that stuff, which might be true. I don't know, but we'll look at some data there. So to start, hey, happy $66 silver for the first time. This is a monthly chart, Paul. That charts like this normally scare me. That looks a little blow-offy, parabolic, you know, but it won't stop. It just won't stop. These are monthly candles. So monthly, like brand new high, six in a row. What does this look like to you with your charting experience?
That really looks like a regime change. And quite frankly, moves like that normally scare me dramatically. Like I'm looking to try to sell in as soon as you see some weak momentum. But the fundamentals from a long-term standpoint are still so strong. The question is the market adjusting its price quickly? Because things are moving faster now than they have before. So do I want to go chase it right now? Not necessarily, but that's another check mark in the box of the long-term fundamentals starting to take over on silver.
Well, yeah, and those fundamentals, of course, as we've described, extraordinary structural weakness in supply versus demand. So demand... Just industrial demand, Paul, it looks like it's going to exceed mine supply. And, of course, we have this rumor came out. Not a rumor, but, well, sort of rumor. But Samsung has developed this new silver battery, right? So there's different battery chemistries. And this one uses silver with lithium in a what's called a solid-state configuration, which means that it's not that polymer gel, which means it's not subject to catching on fire. You can apparently charge it in, like, 9 minutes or something to go, you know, full charge. I don't know what the cable would look like charging that, but like my leg. But at any rate, so if that comes true and they get that into production and it looks like they're gonna, obviously that's a new source of demand. So that will be even harder. So at that point, Paul, if silver gets to a place where there's 105% industrial demand compared to mine output, Vince Lancey told me last week that somebody he tracks had calculated, because it's a very inelastic metal, meaning a little shortfall leads to this giant ding increase in price. He calculated a 5% shortfall leads to a 200% price increase. So that's kind of the territory we're in, but this could really run a lot further. This chart's telling me something is fundamentally, like you said, regime change. Something has fundamentally changed, and I'm not even entirely sure you and I can find out what it is, because the data is hidden, but the price action is telling us something's afoot.
The data is hidden. And one of the things that I love about technical analysis, price action typically leads the news, because you've got your insiders and your big institutions that are the big money that tends to move first. They're the early adopters when you move into one of these trends. And one thing I've learned, you know, you go back to 2007 or 2000, fundamentals look great, but then all of a sudden the market starts rolling over, and then you find out 6 to 9 months later that the fundamentals look great in hindsight, but they weren't by the time you get the data. It looks to me like we're going to find out 6 to 9 months from now what's driving this price action, assuming truth actually comes out. And because it's telling us something major. I mean, normally you're going to have some pullback when you hit that all-time high that goes back to 2011 and 12. And I was hesitant to start adding for people who don't have exposure to it at that time. And then you blow out of that resistance, you know, with a clear breakout. So we're going to get some volatility, especially if the market sells off in 2026. But from everything that we're looking at right now, that's potentially, for the right person in strategy and portfolio, going to be a gift for a buying opportunity when we look at long-term fundamentals.
Yeah, and of course, it's got a compatriot here, which is gold, also setting new monthly records here, just sort of powering up. So these are monthly candles, so that's higher than that, which was higher than that, which is higher than that, and that. So we have 5 straight monthly gains here after sort of bouncing around at the 3,500 level, and then we had 4 straight monthly gains preceding that, little bouncing around here. So gold seems to like take a run, take a rest, take a run. That's how it's behaving right now.
And what's interesting is that short little consolidation period, and then we work our way up to where we are right now. And we've been consolidating for the most part since October, when we hit that price spike. And we're very close to completing that would could be a bull flag to having the other leg. So it's very interesting. I mean, we're not confirmed that we're going to have that next leg in the move, but if we break up, it sure looks like that's what gold wants to do. It's amazing the demand after a run like this in gold and silver.
Yeah, it just keeps getting bought. As we've described, the market behavior is different. If you watch the futures, the paper markets in the U.S., that's the COMEX paper futures, for a long time, the pattern was gold would run up and then it would get capped at no more than a 2% daily rise, or it would get slammed in the middle of the night with these bear raids that would come and just paper contracts sold in. Those are getting bought now, and I'm starting to detect a little panic. I heard a rumor that for silver, the big banks in the U.S. have kind of cleared out their shorts, and somehow they pawned them off on European banks, which kind of fits, because in this story, the U.S. banks are Lucy and the European banks are Charlie Brown with the football, right? Just every time. Nothing personal. But, I mean, come on. Like, looking at what happened to Deutsche Bank during, you know, all the stuff that got foisted off on them at the last minute by Goldman Sachs and AIG and stuff. It's terrible.
Well, and another thing that's amazing is when those middle of the night price slams come for silver, normally you start, you know, when this bull started to run, it was usually midday before somebody would move in, or kind of after the market closed. Now yeah. It seems near instantaneous that they're stepping in. So it looks to me like somebody's given a gift to those that are trying to buy silver at this point with those middle of the night slams.
Every gift is being taken and received. And of course, that's a huge change in trend. I don't know. So this could get to a point where it gets really disorganized, as they like to say, meaning we could see something like we saw with, what was that, palladium back in the 90s. We saw it with nickel in just 2 years ago, where you see these things where it's not going up $3-4 a day. It's going up 100%, 200%. That's an actual silver or commodity short squeeze, because you're short all this paper and you just can't get your hands on the physical. So I think this is setting up this part, Paul, where I am extra keenly focused is all the contracts. So the contracts, the paper contracts where all the shorts are concentrated, settle out on some months. Silver's next big month is March, and that's where the giant battles. We're going to watch a lot of battling between here and then, because it's possible in March more people could stand for delivery than exists, and that's when you get that giant setup. So we'll see how that plays out.
Well, and you know, the news that you had shared with me with India having the ability to capitalize their banks or loan against their silver 10-to-1. I mean, think about it. If you're an Indian bank, and from what I understand, that takes place either mid-January or mid-February, it goes live, okay? So it's a tier one asset within gold is a tier one asset within U.S. banks. We've seen that demand. I mean, look, if you're an Indian bank at this point and you can loan 10-to-1 on silver, then why are you not going to buy all the silver that you can possibly buy all the way up to $300, up to $400 an ounce? where gold is right now, because you're effectively in a position to create money. So, you know, that's a government incentive within a very wealthy country that has the ability to create demand. If I'm an Indian bank, I'm not worried about the spike here in the short run, and I don't care if it drops a little bit in the short run either. I want to buy as much as I can because I've got this really high number that I can loan against based on government incentives. So I just don't, you know, look, it's very dangerous to say I can't see how the prices can pull back. I can see exactly how the prices pull back if we get a nasty recession in 2026 and the market starts selling off and the deleveraging comes out of the system. There's going to be people that are going to be forced to sell that silver price down in the short run, but that's not going to change the long-term fundamentals from where we are right now.
Well, this whole time, every morning I wake up, Shanghai silver is like $2 more expensive than it is over here. And of course, that creates an arbitrage opportunity where you would buy it here, sell it there. All you have to do is put it on a ship and get it there within the contract delivery period, right? So those usually don't persist. It's been persisting the whole time. And so if I was President Xi or Modi, I would be saying, look, all I want as many ounces inside my country as possible. Caught dollars. What are dollars worth? I mean, let's look at this. So China's running the largest trade surplus on record. So it has $1.1 trillion of trade surplus to deal with for this year. That's a lot of money to buy stuff with. You know,
it sure is. It sure is.
So what do you do with all that? When you run a trade surplus that large, you either store it in digits on a Oracle database on a computer representing somebody else's currency, or you do something with it. And you get real stuff inside your borders. That's the plan I see. This is going to become a great sector rotation back into all things real. We've been in fantasy land. It's all things paper for a while. That's great. Pendulum doth swing back and forth. That's why I think we're going to really, it's out of favor right now, Paul, but I guarantee you, well, as close as I can, there's going to be a lot more interest coming back into commodities. And I can guarantee that because the interest is pretty close to zero right now. Really doesn't have much further to go than up at this stage.
Oh yeah, and I know I've shared this several times, but there may be somebody out there that's not seen. Hang on, for the sake of taking y'all through, let me make sure I've got it pulled up here, because I want to show just the big picture view of what the major indexes have been in since 2008, and just the complete lack of focus on any commodities in any way whatsoever. So what I'm showing you here is just a performance chart. The black line is the S&P 500 going back to January 1st of 2008. The blue line is the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index. Okay, just commodities
in general, line.
The index. Yeah, mm-hmm. Flat. It's still 11.6% below what it was January 1st, 2008, which is near 17 years ago now. Okay, emerging markets have started to kind of climb a little bit, but what we're seeing is this just unbelievable chase and this herd mentality into the S&P 500 index. But slowly under the surface, we're starting to see gold has started to gain some dollars flowing in. Silver has. There's a few other commodities, and general commodities haven't started moving. But what I want to remind investors, we've been here before. Okay, technology bubble 1.0 from 1990 to the year 2000. Now, it was relatively expensive to get the extra data to here, and it doesn't change this much. So this isn't exact. But the point is, commodities and emerging markets completely underperform. Now, remember, a lot of your emerging markets are going to be your commodity-producing countries. So when commodities do good, those investments tend to do better. But this was leading up into bubble 1.0, okay, or internet bubble 1.0 that popped in the year 2000. But from 2000 to 2007, look at that regime change, okay? S&P 500 went sideways for 7 years. Actually, it went sideways for 14 years. Mm-hmm. And emerging markets, in spite of going down just as much as the S&P 500 did from 2000 to 2003, they were up 155%. Commodities were up 213%. And then I think I've got it down here. That leadership within commodities and emerging markets lasted until at least 2011, 2012. I have year end 2010 here. So in spite of that massive liquidation in commodities, they rallied back up over a 10-year period where the S&P lost 14%, okay, and mathematically we're close to the same valuations, actually more expensive now than we were in the year 2000. But commodities were up 227 and emerging markets were up 136. So what's important to me from that standpoint, modern portfolio theory and passive investing is not going to make an adaptation over until the rear view mirror looking back of 5 to 7 years when that herd mentality of retail starts shifting into the other area, then they're going to try to start making some adaptations. So, you know, to me, it's ridiculously important to have a strategy that can make that adaptation to overweight those, because you're not just a cookie cutter approach. This is really a generational opportunity that we see right here. Feds, you know, however you want to phrase it, seems to have started quantitative easing again. You know, they're wanting to cut rates. The Trump administration is not fiscally responsible in any way whatsoever. Okay, so their answer is, let's just print, print, print. Okay, so, but not necessarily what has worked for the past 10 years is going to work as well going forward. And I'm seeing all kinds of indication that big money is starting to leave the AI trade. They're starting to shift out of that, and they're going into real things. Because if they're gonna run it hot and they're gonna inflate this economy, then all the things that we have to have are gonna get more expensive, and all the things that we want to have are gonna get a lot cheaper. Because the large majority of the populace is going to have to spend all of their resources on the things that they have to have, and they're not going to have much left over for what they want to own.
And we'll get into that with electricity and the AI thing, because that's a have to have, right? You kind of have to have your refrigerator running, right? It's a thing. So we'll get to that in a second. But in that, so needs versus wants, I like that. But you mentioned before Japan, right? 10-year highest, I think, in history, right? And I think they're actually entertaining having to hike at this point, because they have huge inflation going on over there, right? I think it's running 4.5% right now, last I heard. And so they have to hike, and they don't want to hike. But of course, as Japan hikes, their interest costs for the government go up. Our interest costs are going up. I can't see anything to sort of default or stop that train, right? Trump is going to spend recklessly, right? Congress isn't going to do anything about it. That's just how it is. Let me know if you see anything different in that. And also, the yield curve has started to steepen, I think, really a lot in the U.S. because the Fed is bringing short rates down, but long rates are going the wrong way. So it's a pretty steep yield. So the government has to borrow across this whole structure. So as these go up, its borrowing costs go up. And that brings me to this chart, which is, I hadn't seen this one before. This is the correlation starting in 2007 between gold in blue and global government interest expense in red. That, I haven't seen this one before. What a correlation.
Oh, I've not seen that either. That's an incredible correlation right there. That's an interesting data point right there. It really is.
So, I mean, you know, as government interest expenses go up, also, let's notice here, we're starting to get that same parabolic blow-off. So the more government has to borrow, the higher its interest expense, the higher the interest expense, the more it has to borrow. And it's just, that's a train that goes like that. Where it really gets out of control is if your yield blows out on top of that. That's where Japan is right now.
Yes, yes. And I've got a chart that I can show just to put in perspective how fast the 10-year in Japan has moved.
It's incredible. Let's take a peek at that. But this, yeah, while you're pulling that up, I'm going to have to sit on this one for a bit, because That's 18 years, so that's pretty, okay. I hadn't had that one in my quiver before, so I'm going to keep an eye on that one.
No, my mind's going in 1,000 different directions. So, you know, is the question that big investors are realizing, hey, they're just going to debase the purchasing power of my currency, so I'd rather own gold, and I've got the added benefit of default risk on the other side of that?
There, I think that's the magic sauce, the default risk control.
That to me is ridiculously important. So here, I'll share that chart. There's two of them. I'll show them in different manners. But this is the Japanese 10-year. We're, you know, as of yesterday, look at this. I mean, the poor soul, ooh, right, that had to buy these in 2020 at negative rates. And then, you know, this was looks to me like this is the left hand and the right hand that lost grip of that basketball that was being held underwater.
Yep.
And then poof, it took off to the top side right here.
Wow.
Look at that. And then here's another chart just to put it in perspective. So this was end of day yesterday, and this is a monthly chart. But you're talking about an 8.19% increase so far in the first 17 days of December.
Yikes.
You know, and just look, it's gaining momentum right here. So that's something structurally changing and fundamentally changing within within the Japanese interest rate and borrowing market. I mean, it's and we don't even have any negative divergences up here on relative strength at this point. So, you know, what do you do if you're a business at this point? I mean, that's a dramatic change overnight that nobody took into consideration, at least from a government level, how we're going to pay for this, because that's ridiculously higher. So it looks like the market, you know, bond market vigilantes, you know, it's not broken across the board, but they're starting to say enough is enough. And then, you know, just to show, you know, that steepening yield curve that you were talking about, this to me, I've been watching, it's moving slow here within the U.S. right now. But, you know, the Fed just cuts rates, okay, here in December. So up here, this is the 30, 20, 10, 5, 3, 2, 1 year and 3 month. So you've got your shorter terms that are going down, which the Fed can control. But look at this. So you've had the 5-year that's been consolidating, essentially going back to, I've got something at the bottom, going back to really about here in September, and then it breaks out of that range. Your 20 and 30 year is starting to break out of that range as well. So, you know, higher highs and higher lows, which shows us that a trend is establishing that interest rates want to go higher. And what's that going to do to the housing market, Chris? It's already frozen right now. You've got taxes that are going up across the board because these governments are spending foolishly. And they're like, oh, we got higher prices, so let's reset it and let's raise our taxes. You got insurance costs that are going through the roof across the board. And there's a lag on that, you know, because you're in that contract for a year period of time. And then the unaffordability crisis is already ridiculous. So, you know, what's this catalyst for real estate? So where's our next driver of the economy? The only thing that we're relying on right now is AI, and there's all kinds of cracks under the surface with AI right now. But Chris, the next leg of the AI trade is going to be data centers in space. That's the newest thing now, how to make money off of data centers in space. So anyway, I'm being a little facetious here.
All right. I had to find this. That's why my eyes went down for a second, because we have to talk about this now. So people don't know this maybe yet, but the Fed has started printing money again. It's QE. Oh, no, I'm sorry. We have to get a new acronym in our heads. It's Reserve Balance Management. It's RBM, not QE. See how they're different, Paul?
Mm-hmm.
Here's what comes up. So, but it's germane to your thing about how the Fed's controlling the short end. Here's what they're doing just between the 12th, which is a few days ago, and the 22nd, they've announced it, $8 billion, 6.8, 8, 8, 8, 6.8, right? So $32 billion of purchases, all of T-bills, 1 to 4 months, 4 to 12 months. So basically 1 to 12 months, T-bills. $32 billion in 10 days. We're back, baby. They are printing. So you talk about that affordability crisis. I'm watching these kids. Some young guy posted the thing about how mac and cheese, you know, to make it for his large family was $90, you know. You hear people, oh my gosh, what I'm hearing, Paul, particularly out of your state, I don't know what's going on with your insurance commissioner, but the auto and homeowners insurance down there, I don't even know what's happening that I've been hearing. Just extraordinary, just punishing increases. And so what we're getting is that is this the bottom end, and by the bottom, I mean the bottom 90% are just getting squeezed here really hard. So sooner or later, people are going to have to make that decision. Do I pay? Do I have insurance? Do I fly naked without insurance, right? You know, on my home, health, auto? Do I buy food? Do I, you know, what do I do here? Because people are going to have to start making that decision set. And the Fed is printing more money. That's their response to this. Because stocks, financial assets, have to always go up in price.
Yeah, and I've said it before, and I'll say it again. those that are in the halls of power have so much wealth and they're so detached from the reality of the average citizen.
Yeah.
They have no clue what is taking place across the board. And Georgia's a joke from an insurance standpoint. If you drive from Chattanooga and cross the Georgia line all the way down to the Florida line, 9 in 10 of the billboards that you're going to see are for these ambulance chasing attorneys, because that's the most profitable thing in Georgia right now. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous if you have some type of fender bender, the settlements that these guys are getting in the state of Georgia. And our politicians are talking about tort reform and getting all this changed, but they're all attorneys, the large majority of them. So they're just protecting their own industry at this point at the expense of the citizens of Georgia. I mean, even from my standpoint, our insurance went up a lot. My wife went to pick up some 6x6s at Lowe's for us one day when we were working on a pole barn. And she swings in. She's hauled trailers all her life, but she swings in and it sweeps the front bumper on this guy. So she calls me and I'm like, hey, it's probably $1,500 worth of damage. Just let me pay the guy. I don't want to turn it in on insurance. He refused, turned it in on insurance. I can't even move to another insurance company at this point right now because we have a $1,500 claim. You know, my deductible was $1,000, I think. I raised it after that. But because no insurance company wants to take you if you have any claim. I've not had any claims in 12, 15 years.
Isn't that the point of insurance? The point of insurance is you pay into it, and every so often something happens, and you pool the risk, and that's how it is. But they're like, oh, no, because you had a claim.
Yeah.
You're untouchable now. Like that's not the point.
It's
not how it's supposed to work.
We used to have a good insurance commissioner, but not anymore.
Oh, and we'll get into that in just a second with how bad leadership can kill you. But we're going to talk next about this jobless recovery. There's really weak economic data coming in. We talk about that decoupling of the elites from everybody else. Boy, we got to talk about that as soon as we hear from our favorite sponsor. We'll be right back after this. Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. All right, welcome back, everybody. Paul, we're going here now. The jobless recovery. Remember we read that stupid headline, that charming headline out of Yahoo Finance? We're facing a jobless recovery, and you and I were like, what even is that? Okay. It's also called unemployment. Let's listen in now to J.D. Vance doing what he has to do, I think, because he's parroting his boss. But let's listen in. Short clip here.
President Trump last week gave his economy a grade of A++++. What grade would you give the economy today?
A++++.
That sounded fake to me, a little fake, but A++++. That's the economy reading he's going to give here right now. Paul, I talk to a lot of people in my profession here, and I talk to a lot of young people specifically because I want to hear what they have to say. They would call it a generously D-. What's going on here?
Well, first off, did you notice how he started to laugh immediately before he responded? Yeah. I think his initial reaction was like, yeah, well, that's a little propaganda coming out there. But But yeah, I mean, they seem the only thing they care about. Trump seems to care about this at this point is, hey, the market, you know, is holding up at this point. We technically hit a closing new high. But it's just, it seems to be narrative. It seems to absolutely be narrative and propaganda. It's not the truth of what we're seeing out there under the surface. It's not the truth of what I'm seeing from individuals that if they have their jobs now across the country, and I'm talking high paying jobs, they're really worried because nobody's able to job jump at this point. And then you just look at the numbers across the board.
Yeah, the housing market's frozen, like you said, so that can complicate moving. Right. If you have to move, sometimes you have to sell a house. But I mean, come on, look at this. The U.S. economy has barely added any jobs since April. Right. So, mm-hmm. you know, these are kind of like November was 64. They said October was minus 105. September was 108. August was minus 26. I mean, we're just sort of like having a heart attack there. When you look at it this way, Bolello showing the monthlies, you can just sort of spot the trend. Right. And what's interesting is he put this up in a different chart, which shows U.S. non-farm payrolls year-over-year change from September of 79 through November of 2025. You can clearly see we're about to tag the zero line here, and every single time we've tagged the zero line, it's gone into recession. Maybe this time is different, right? Mm-hmm. The only bright spot I found in the unemployment data looking forward was this, that under Trump, federal employment is down a couple hundred thousand, maybe 270,000. I consider that a positive. I think, yes, these numbers went up enormously under Biden. A lot of make work programs. I'm of the position that we don't need this many people in government at state, municipal, or federal levels. I think we have too many doing too many things, and they justify doing those things by putting more rules on people so that they can justify doing their jobs. And yeah, I think we could use some fewer rules at this point in time, at least in my state. That's
I agree
for sure.
with you. I agree with you completely.
And when we look at this across sectors, in November, if it wasn't for this big pink bar, which is health services, private education, which is nominal. I don't know why they bundle that. But if it wasn't for healthcare hiring, look at all the negatives here, which is mining and logging down, manufacturing down, wholesale trade down, transportation and warehousing, which is weird to hear those U-line guys screaming about how great the economy is because this is their economy. Information, financial activities, professional and business services, and government, all to the negative. Construction, modestly up. Retail, up. Utilities, barely up. We talked about healthcare. Leisure and hospitality, interesting. That's normally something that rolls in a period of weakness. I don't know what other services is, but that's sort of how it breaks out. It's not a healthy economy at this point in time. It's kind of a mixed bag at best.
And I think the leisure and hospitality is distorted by the baby boomers. They're at a point where their asset prices are high. A lot of them are retiring. You know, I think it's still 10,000 a day that are retiring at this point. I haven't looked at that number in a while. But, hey, you know, if you're modern portfolio theory passive and you have no clue what's taking place under the surface, as long as the market's holding up, you're going to be spending money on travel and hospitality and going out. So I think the baby boomers and them owning the large, you know, the majority of the assets and those asset price inflation is working for their benefit has distorted the leisure and hospitality at this point in the cycle.
Where are we in the cycle? Here you can see long term, going back to the 50s, the unemployment rate, which is the percentage of people who are looking for work but can't find any, which is a weird number because of how they add it up. But regardless, the way they add it up, you see it tends to flatten out for a while, and then unemployment spikes right before a recession. Flattens out and spikes, flattens out and spikes. Oh, this one just sort of U-turned here in the mid-70s. Flattens out and spikes. So you sort of see that behavior, the flatten and then the spike of unemployment as you go. What's interesting, Paul, this is very unusual. We had the flattening, and it's, look at all this climb, without a gray bar, right? So some people have said it feels like a recession. I don't understand what's happening, but technically we're not in one. I think what's happening is that we're not in a technical recession because the government is spending 7% of GDP to keep us out of a technical recession. And that, of course, has its own costs downstream because then you have the interest costs and all this other stuff. So I think they're doing everything they can to avoid. They're papering it over as best they can, hoping they can sort of spend their way through this, which is going to have a big implication in our AI story that's coming up. But see that 2020 from 2021, let's dial in on that. Here, this is the big flattening, and it is creeping back up. And by the way, 4.6% is kind of a line in the sand here. It really is. This is about where we see a lot of recessionary sort of activity kick in. It's not full employment. It's not total recession yet, but add it all up, Paul, the labor market's looking very weak right now by these numbers.
It really is. And if you notice in that chart, those recessions are cyclical. Like, they don't have a perfect rhythm, mm-hmm. but they're cyclical, and then they work themselves out until it's all purged out in the early 1980s, right? All the excess mm-hmm. is purged out, and then they get a little further apart. Then the last nasty recession, I mean, yeah, 2020 was a technical recession because government shutdowns, but look at all of the effort, all of the national debt, all of the money that they have printed to try to kick this can down the road. And yes, they have kicked the can down the road, but all it's done is make the inevitable outcome far worse than what it would have been if we'd have had these cyclical recessions as time goes along and clear out the debt, you know, the companies that should be cleared out and let it go into, let them, you know, those business models shift into stronger hands. So, yep. you know, the longer they can kick this can down the road, the worse the inevitable outcome is going to be.
Yeah, that's a really great point. Let me see if I can draw in here. I'll get the laser pointer out. So what you notice here, Paul, is these recessions were fairly repeated here in the 50s up through 1960, kind of a big stretch here. Then, you know, they repeated again. This is the double dip recession here. And then, you know, another one, but right about here in 2000, this is when the Federal Reserve got really intervention-y. And so they created this, which was the Great Financial Crisis. But if it hadn't been for COVID, which is a technical gray recession, this is the longest uninterrupted non-recession stretch ever. But of course, the Fed had to print trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars in here. And of course, the government completely lost any fiscal restraint during that same period. So this is an unusual period. And you know what? Recessions are good. In the sense that I'm not happy anybody loses their job, but in a recession, the weak companies get weeded out. It plows the field so that new, more dynamic, better run companies can take the place of the ones that failed. And so it's sort of like having a brush fire in a forest can be healthy for a lot of forests. But if you stop that for too long and the brush builds up, you can have what's called the crown fire, and then it burns everything down. Good trees, bad trees, dead trees, everything. And that's how I see this. I see the Fed has been basically in cahoots with the federal government, conspiring to prevent any recession from ever happening. And I think that's just laid the fuel for a barn burner of a recession, should one get started. I think that's what's driving their behavior. That's why they're printing $36 billion in 10 days. They're desperately afraid of any weakness showing up. But it's their own fault for allowing so much weakness to build up underneath the surface.
That is absolutely right. And on top of that, the worst part about this is passive investing has been marketed so heavily starting in the 1990s. And Michael Green's done a phenomenal job of explaining how it has distorted the market to the upside. And when this thing changes, he's got a theory, which makes a lot of sense, that it's going to distort it to the negative side too. Once the baby boomers or once we have a recession that forces the tipping of pulling those out of the system. But what's worse from my point of view is the complacency that has cast upon your average investor. I mean, I don't blame them for being complacent, but it's not only just your retail investor that's complacent at this point, it's your professional investor. Because if you're a professional investor that's embraced wisdom and studied history, and you're working for one of these big corporations, people realize there's a C-suite above the managers of the mutual funds and the ETFs that are out there. So for the individuals that have navigated past cycles very well, they're like, hey, this is not going to end well. They lower risk during periods of time, about the time the Fed steps in and prints money. Well, guess what? When those investors start chasing their returns, because the majority of investors, when they look at their 401k, they go, oh, that was the best performing thing in the past. So that's what I'm going to add to. So that's this herd mentality that fuels it until it runs out of fuel and everybody gets on the same side of the boat. That comes apart. But guess what? They've replaced all of your experienced, wise, prudent investors with younger investors who don't understand the cycles of the past. And all they know is, hey, the Fed's going to bail it out. And I don't want to be like that guy that got fired that I used to respect. And I want to keep my job. So this is the new normal. I mean, nobody's saying it because they've heard it enough in the past that it's the new normal, but that's exactly how everyone is behaving. And you got a period of time right now where the market looks to be consolidating and topping. We'll get into that whenever you're ready. But leverage is increasing dramatically, and that leverage increasing and investors embracing these leveraged ETFs and the introduction of these leveraged ETFs, they're offering products that have demand that people are taking advantage of right now, because there's a full belief, whether subconscious or conscious, that the Fed's going to save the day. And we're going to go into this blow off, melt up top. And Trump's telling people that it's the best economy that we've ever had, and that nobody's paying attention to the data. Most people look at the news, but they never actually do the research to go in and see if what he's saying has a basis behind it. So, I mean, we're set up for a period of time. If they do not pull this off with perfection, mm-hmm. the damage that it's going to do to people who think that they have generational wealth is going to be absolutely horrific.
I totally agree. And if we track this story from here, and again, this is just a story of debt, massive, massive debt and money printing and all of that other stuff, right? And so during this period, we saw a total explosion in the number of billionaires, centimillionaires, decamillionaires, millionaires, right? So, and a lot of these people feel good because by historical standpoint, you know, I got 5 million, I'm doing good. But if you watch the cut line, Paul, I'm watching now people who used to earn $50,000 felt they could get by, and then it was $80,000. Professor Green thinks $140,000 is the number. But, Paul, I'm hearing my first squawking sounds from people who are earning $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 a year going, whoa, shocking, shocking. This cost, that cost, right, whatever it is, property taxes, insurance, you know, even at the food store. That cut line, every time the Fed prints, it just goes higher and higher. And so they're going to print again. And so my advice would be to anybody who feels comfortable right now but kind of on the edge, you're going to be on the wrong side of that line before too long, because the Fed's going to print. That's what they do. And they don't care that they throw another cohort of people under the bus wheels of inflation, because they've trapped themselves at this point, I think.
And at this point, I would venture to say that Trump's pride is going to, you know, I've come to the... I bashed the prior administration. I said, I don't know that there's any line that they're willing to cross to try to stay in power. Okay. I'm going to say the same thing about the Trump administration. I don't think there's any line that they're willing to cross, not necessarily to stay in power, but to try to kick this can down the road to where it comes apart on somebody else's watch.
Any line they're unwilling to cross, because they will cross.
Unwilling to cross.
Every line.
Correct.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So, when we come back, we got to talk about this AI bubble. Paul, this is one of the most astonishing pieces of data I've seen so far to help put it in context. We've all been waiting for it. Somebody finally did it. But we have to talk about this AI bubble just as soon as we come back from this message. Hey, folks, Chris Martinson here. Look, we've all been there watching our hard-earned dollars get chewed up by this endless inflation machine, while the folks in Washington and the big banks continue to play games with our money like it's Monopoly cash or something. It's not right. I know it, and you know it. The trust in the system? It's eroding faster than a sandcastle at high tide, especially with all the geopolitical storms brewing. Now, I've been saying it for years. You've got to protect yourself, your family, from all this nonsense. That's why I personally turn to gold and silver, the real deal, physical stuff that you can hold in your hands under your control. Not some digital promise that could vanish overnight. Everyone should own some. It's just common sense in times like these. But here's the thing. When I need it stored securely, away from prying eyes, I use Goldcorp. They're the ones I trust. They ship it right to your door, really quick if you want to hold it in your hands. But also, if you prefer, they can stash it in top-tier vaults in places like Switzerland or Singapore or right here in the United States. Your call, your metal. And for you, my friends who follow Peak Prosperity, they'll hook you up with the first 6 months of storage absolutely free. That's how much they value real people like us. Buying and selling? Hey, it's as easy as trading stocks, but way better. Because with Goldcorp, you're the sole owner. Fully allocated, fully segregated, in your name only. No sharing with strangers, no funny business, no security entitlement nonsense. Need cash fast? Sell in seconds at market price? Want it in your hands? Hey, one click and it's shipped. They've got everything from coins and bars to allowing for self-directed IRAs, all locked down and secure. It's simple, it's safe, and straightforward. Take charge of your future, folks. Don't wait for the system to fail you any further. Head over to peak.fan/goldcore. That's peak.fan/goldcore right now and claim that free storage. You won't regret it. I sure don't. Welcome back, everybody. Paul, AI bubble. I know we talk about the AI bubble. What are we talking about? First off, this is the 1 month performance across the NASDAQ. So you see, Facebook is doing really well down here. It's got a 1 month performance of 8%. But check this out: NVIDIA -7%. AMD down 13.6. AVGO, Microsoft. These were the big sort of drivers of, you can clearly see there's some weakness showing up. Mm-hmm. I think the weakness is showing up because some reality has started to sneak in. So this is astonishing. So I'm going to play this. Let me turn off. I don't want the sound on this because sometimes music gets you caught. Okay. All right. Let me back this up. So what we're watching is, up here, this is money flowing in. So this is customer revenue, external revenue, and also market revenue. So they sell stock or equity, and so cash in. And then this is cash flowing out. So this is operating expenses, expenditures, all that. And each one of these little dots, we're watching where the money is flowing. And over here, these are the two numbers to watch. This is revenue, and this is investment right here. So 2019, things really haven't gotten started yet. And so we start this, and these little balls are running. And look at this, through 2019, revenues and expenses are kind of close. Not too bad. Okay. 2020, now we're starting to see investment costs, the capital costs, are starting to outpace revenue here through 2020. So now it's starting to flow a little bit. And more and more balls are entering this, because I think each ball represents 10 billion or billion or something. I forget what they are. Should stay down there somewhere. $1 billion for each ball. And now we're in 2022. Uh-oh, Paul. This is 2x'd. Expenses are now 2x revenues. And remember, a bubble exists when asset prices rise beyond what incomes can sustain. Now we're at closing in on $450 billion with only $170 billion of revenue. Now we're coming into 24. Now things are really picking up. And this is going to cast forward into the future based on projections of what people say they're going to spend. This may or may not come to be true. Now, here we are. It's 2x'd again. Now we're hundreds of billions of dollars deep into this story. This is what's been supporting the economy. That's a lot of money to be spending right there. And CapEx like that has a multiplier effect that's pretty large. Now we're a trillion in. And here we're into the future, flowing along. And this is what everybody's expecting is going to, when you look at the forward guidance for earnings, right? So NVIDIA or Microsoft, again, neither for or against any particular owning of any share. This is purely educational, not investment advice. But these are the projections that people are basing their forward price earnings multiples on. They're saying, look at all this activity that's going to happen. And by the way, would you just look at the number of balls flowing out of NVIDIA down into this whole thing? And so by 2029, they say that they're going to be out there at, where are we at? 2029, December 2030, $2.7 trillion of expenditure against $1.3 trillion of income is the projections. So this is all going to pencil out somehow, I guess, at some point. And this is the story, and this is how it's currently articulated, and this is how people are invested across this universe of companies, because this is what the expectations are. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so we're almost at the end here, and heck, we don't have to go much further because we're going to make the point. So we're basically at $4 trillion of expenses, less, just round up, $2 trillion of revenue. Whew. Paul, the numbers never close. The gap never closes. No. So here's why, and what a great visualization. So that really helped me understand the universe a lot better. Okay, so what could possibly cause all of, even as projected, it's not a rational story, okay?
No.
Because your revenues have to catch up with your expenses at some point, right? And it's not rational because you and I both know that a lot of that capital expenditure, especially the stuff flowing on NVIDIA, has a capitalization life cycle for depreciation of 2 to 5 years, typically around 2 to 3 years. Okay. So you have to, at some point within a 2-year cycle, 3-year cycle, depending on the depreciation schedule, the expenses and revenues have to line up. They just have to for any business, just how it is. So, but all of this depends on a lot of things happening, and all those billions flowing out of NVIDIA require chips, and those are chips that are going into data centers. Okay. Notice we're out here 2032. I can put a bullet in this story right here. This is a projection that's coming out of the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, Schneider Electric. They're saying, hey, this is the peak power supply we're going to need in gigawatts here. And here's the actual peak supply anticipated. And there's no such thing as a gap in electricity supply, Paul. You can project one, but you can't have a supply shortfall in electricity. It doesn't actually work. Your grid becomes unstable. The Hertz cycles get out of whack and your grid goes down. So this won't, the yellow line won't happen, but all of that stuff we were just watching here is depending on this yellow line is baked into those future assessments of where AI is going to be. So the next question is, okay, well, if we don't have this as part of our national grid, where does it come from? Oh, that's easy. You do on-site generating, okay? And Lucas Equimi here says the AI bubble rests on a critical assumption that unlimited data centers can be built on aging, fragile power grids. They can't. Reality disagrees, which we just saw in that other chart. Only 10% of planned data centers are built or are even under development. Data center spending is down 50% year over year already. Grid interconnection takes 5 to 8 years now. So guess what? That's why on-site generation has become mandatory. And you put this chart up. Oh, if you want to buy a gas turbine for on-site generating, your wait time is 5 to 7 years. Ta-da.
That's incredible.
That's the whole story.
5 to 7 years?
Mm-hmm. Oh. So everybody's projecting, look at all this CapEx we're going to be doing, and it's great, even though don't pay attention to the fact the revenue doesn't support that. This is what's going to go forward, but the reality is we don't have the power to do it, and we don't have the equipment to do it. So how's it going to get done?
Okay, so let's talk this through for a minute. So if I just stood back, and I could borrow $3 trillion, let's say borrow $4 trillion, to generate $2 trillion in revenue, and I could do it in a power plant, right? Okay, you build that power plant, and it can produce for 20 or 30 years. That's great. That's a good borrowing of the money to produce that long-term income. But you've got $4 trillion on $2 trillion of revenue, but the cycle on that is really 2 to 3 years on how well they on those chips where you can actually use them, those semiconductors. So if it's 5 years before 5 to 7 years before you can get the power to produce those, what happens to your competitors that are in China that have more power where they can put this in place? And by 3 years, they've upgraded their chips and they're taking over the business market. I mean, go back and look what China did to manufacturing. Does technology think that that's not going to happen in that industry now? So you're right. I mean, that mathematics doesn't work. So by the time some of these actually have their power generation on, the money that they spend on those semiconductor chips are null and void. So what are you going to do? Are you going to build the infrastructure and have everything ready and then wait to buy those chips until you get power? That would be a smarter decision to make so that they're plug and play as soon as you get the power. But what does that do to NVIDIA's revenue in the interim period, right? So... Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. That's fascinating. I love it when people put together something like that.
Oh, I know. I'm so glad they did that. So here's also the difference that we have to talk about, which is that China is, how do we use AI? AI is supposed to give us these incredible productivity improvements, right? So let's grossly just say China is a manufacturing nation and we are a service economy nation. Okay. Now, China's clearly making an investment to use AI to more efficiently streamline manufacturing processes. And I can see how to do that easy. I can visualize that. There might be some bumps along the way. There'll be some learnings, but I can understand that, right? You know, material flows, logistics, robotic processes, tuning stuff, getting feedback, making processes more efficient. I get it. What happens in a service economy? All you and I can figure out is that it takes jobs away. Don't need paralegals, don't need CPAs, don't need whatever, right? So it doesn't make us more efficient. It takes jobs away, which has its own dynamic, right? So these are very different use cases, but we're going to spend trillions and trillions because AI is like this thing we have to have for some reason. But it could, nobody's explained this yet. How are we going to square the circle of having AI in a service economy? I don't understand it. We're 70% service economy. Half those jobs could go away, best guess.
Well, I mean, it that's the thing. It can eliminate the service jobs. So last night I was fascinated. I walk in. It's funny. This guy's got my wife walks in coming in from the grocery store, and the guy's got his phone there. So he's calling a restaurant that has implemented artificial intelligence for their scheduling. Okay. Normally you'd call the hostess, and I know you can go to OpenTable and a few things like that. So he's just pushing it to see how far it can go. It's fascinating to me. So to make a long story a little bit shorter, he says, hey, I want to have a reservation for four people at this time on Friday night, 8 o'clock. And AI responds, yeah, we can do that. And he's like, oh, no, wait, there's five people. And then AI takes a second to think about it. And then she says, would you like to confirm? He goes, oh, well, do you have a kids menu? And, and the AI is like, oh, yes, we do have a kids menu. And he's like, well, okay, I want to, change this in this manner. And asking all these questions, where you get a normal hostess that's really busy, at some point she's going to lose it and say, do you want the reservation or not, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the AI was just as kind as it could be and then confirms the reservation and then upsells on a couple of things. Do you want some flowers? Do you want this or that? Just as pleasant an experience as can be. But that's jobs that are gone. Right. Normally high school, college kids could come in and be hostesses and start serving, robotics could do serving at some point in the future. But you take that and various other service directors, that increases unemployment, which is deflationary from an income standpoint. Technically, that, supposedly will help the profits of the corporations. But what happens if you don't have people that don't, if you have people that don't have jobs that can't buy your services? At some point, that's going to hurt your profits. And all the while, China is not trying to compete against super intelligence. They're like, okay, we're going to be the best manufacturers of everything in the world. And I think we talked about it a couple of months ago. Some of these angel investors have pointed out that there are certain manufacturing areas that China has such an advantage that it's uninvestable. It's like we can't even try to compete with them because they have so cornered that market in manufacturing. So it looks like they're playing the long game instead of trying to get this AI god that the U.S. seems to be trying to develop. They're like, okay, we can't reach that right now, but we're going to make manufacturing so efficient and establish our dominance in that area. That's great, Trump. You want to pull manufacturing back to the United States, but you're not going to have anybody invest into it because you're not going to be able to compete with us because of the way we have utilized this to increase our dominance. That's my biggest concern from a long-term standpoint.
Well, what would we even compete in? Solar cell manufacturing? Can't. All the silver's in China. What would it be? Car manufacturing? The Ford CEO went over to China and came back scared. His words, right? Saying, oh my, a dark factory because it's just robots. You don't need lights. They're just doing what they do and they're churning out chassis as fast as possible. When I talk to people in other countries, these BYD cars, which we are not allowed to buy here in the U.S., land of the free, on a cost to quality basis, they're untouchable at this point within our car market, right? So, okay, what are we going to compete on? Well, if we get to super AGI, we create God in a box. I think that's bad whether we do or we don't. If it's possible and we don't get there, I guess we lose. But if we do get there, what does that even mean, right? Like now there's this super entity that we can't compete with on a human basis. And who knows what it's going to decide is important. Like it didn't evolve within a social structure over a long period of time under God's rules about how life gets along with itself, right? It's going to be a brand new thing that just from an evolutionary standpoint just got popped into the situation. And I guess our plan is, well, let's hope it's kind.
And just. Let's hope it's kind. Because with all of that data and computing power, it's going to be able to, with the speed of light, monitor every, satellite, camera, transaction, everything across the board. I mean, it's going to know everything about everybody. And you better hope it likes you.
Exactly. So just to put a little more punch on that, a little more, you know, force on the punch, this is electricity prices here as of August 2025, and I've helpfully pointed out all the green states, the green energy states on this, right? And I live in one of them, and so there's literally a 5x spread between, say, North Dakota and my state in terms of electricity costs. Nobody's worse than California at this state stage, except maybe Hawaii, but they're close to each other. I guess Hawaii's a little bit darker. But this is like, listen, you're not going to bring manufacturing to these blue areas here that require electricity. It just, you'd be stupid if you were a manufacturer not to go to one of these low-cost states. So that happens, right? So that's part one. You want to know why my state is so particularly bad? This is, you know, Germany's suffering right now hugely because they had this whole same green energy thing. Unfortunately, my governor at this point. I say unfortunately because of statements like this.
Remember, I stopped two gas pipelines from coming into this state.
She's proud of that. And we now have some of the highest energy costs ever. So she stopped, and she did it for green purposes. But here's why this is so frustrating, Paul. So we still need the gas. We don't take it from a pipeline from the Marcellus field over there in Pennsylvania, which is, if it was a country, is the third largest gas producer in the world. It's fabulous. We could have had cheap piped in gas, but we still need the gas. So what do? Well, because of the Jones Act, it gets liquefied somewhere in Gulfport, Texas, or Freeport, and goes down, and it docks momentarily at some island, Bermuda, Bahama, I forget where. And then it comes up and gets offloaded as LNG. Horribly. We pay the same for gas in my state as they do in anywhere else in the world, like it has to import LNG, like Europe. So horribly expensive, right? Terrible decision. So then this is now really bad. So what's the next thing Mora says? Well, this is her next plan.
And I'm asking now for the President of the United States to do his damn job and figure out a way to get heating assistance out to people who need it. And I'm asking.
Oh, my gosh.
So she
That's
blocks
a special kind
the
of
special kind. So she's saying, hey, I'm going to be mad at President Trump for not getting heating assistance to the people I shortchanged purposefully and proudly, gleefully, pridefully in my own state. It's his fault that my decisions have led to hardship for the people I need to vote for me next cycle. It's just, you can't make this up. You just can't make this up.
Goodness.
And here we go.
So I've been about bringing more gas supply into Massachusetts.
Oh, my goodness.
That's in October. So that's...
Is there no integrity at all?
None. Zero. Zero. And they forget that the internet is forever. I mean, like it's just... I couldn't lie that brazenly to save my life. I mean, I would be unable to do it. And she does it easily. Easily. But this is, I think, the important point here, Paul, is that bad leadership gets you to bad outcomes. It just does. And when you have a leader who doesn't understand the simplest thing in the world, which is cheap gas is the cornerstone of everything in your economy compared to expensive gas, then you're dealing with somebody whose ideology or education is insufficient for the task of managing into reality. And reality is about to come biting back good and hard. And so when we come back, Paul, we're going to talk about what I think is a big old case of reality. This is, I think, the most... I'm going to make the bull case for oil, and I want to know what you think about that as soon as we come back.
Markets are facing heightened uncertainty, and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions.
All right, welcome back, everybody. That's our last break, and we're going to come into this last section. I think oil's setting up for a major bull run here, and Paul, very unpopular, because, of course, took this screenshot a little while ago, $55 a barrel, basically the same as it was in 2005, hasn't been this cheap since 2021. Oil's cheap. It's everywhere. There's too much of it. What are you going to do? All right. Now, I've gone through this before. The great, great analysts over at Gehring and Rosenschwag, and when I interview Adam Rosenschwag, a commodity investor outfit, they put up this chart of shale. So the shale patch has been all the growth in U.S. We don't, conventional oil is on the way out, but shale. So when you look at the year-on-year production growth, like 2023, we're adding 0.8 million barrels per day, basis. But look at this. Can you spot the trend? Now, out of all of the shale basins, the only one that's really growing still is the Permian. And the Permian consists of what are called benches. So as you drill down, a bench would be a band of shale sitting down there. And there could be several benches. One of the most productive bench out of all of them is called the Delaware. So when we dial in on the Delaware, we see here that now in 2025, and by the way, this is total cumulative oil production normalized to 10,000 feet of drilled well. So if you're going to drill 10,000 feet of well, this is how much oil you can expect to get out. And here you can see you used to get this much out in 2021, then 2022, then 2023 and 4 are laid on top of each other here. And then this is 2025. That's a 7% erosion in productivity per year. So that's a trend. It tells you that they drilled all the really good places, and maybe they're drilling the less good places. Maybe the overall pressure in the field is now declining. There's parent-child well interference. Very simply, drilling, getting less per unit drilled. So when the productivity of a field starts to tip over, you're at the end of its life, nearing the peak of its life, but it's going into senescence. You're not at the other end of the story, right? And by the way, they have this other problem, which is for every unit of oil or gas that they're producing huge amounts of water. So in the Permian, in the Delaware, which is that premier bench, they're twice as much produced water as oil and gas. In the Permian, almost twice as much. Eagle Ford gets a little more oil and gas than water, and of course you have to dispose of the water. The Bakken's about even, Steven. And then in the Central Basin in Permian, a lot more water than oil or gas. So you got to do something with all that oil, all that water, and that's a big and rising expense. But here's the thing that is my bull case. You ready? So the EIA puts out something called their Short-Term Energy Outlook, the STEO, the EIA being the Energy Information Agency. This is their 2025 report down here for December, just came out. Here it is. We got more oil and gas, more, in this case, oil. We're going to get less next year. They finally admitted it. We think 2026 is going to be down. It's going to be down even more than that based on that $55 barrel. A lot of people are pulling back CapEx right now. So there it is. There it is. It's right in front of us. Right in front of us. We are at peak oil in the United States. It ought to be a giant topic of conversation, but we have Maura Healey and equivalents all through government. Have no clue what this means. And so I think we're setting up here for a real surprise at some point. Maybe not this week, maybe not even next year, but very soon we're setting up for a major conversion where people go from a story of there's more than we just get more anytime we want to. Oh no, we're going to have less coming out of the ground perpetually, right? Mm-hmm. And to put this in context, oil divided by gold has been a ratio that normally, kicks around at this level. It's outside of that one little moment where we had -$20 a barrel COVID oil, which was a stupid thing. It's never been lower. We're at a place now where oil relative to gold is as cheap as it's ever been. And so either gold's got to fall a lot or oil's got to come up a lot. I think we both know where we would sort of weight the odds on that particular story. But wouldn't you know it, I think it explains this. So just today, President Trump ordered a total and complete blockade of all sanctioned oil tankers going into and out of Venezuela. Venezuela, of course, has the largest oil deposits in the world. Make of that what you will. And that's an act of war. I'm a little disappointed that a president just gets to declare an act of war without any congressional. I think people should have to vote on this kind of stuff. I think there ought to be some discussion, but here we are. And I think these are related events right here. I think this and this are connected. I might be wrong, but it definitely means that we're coming into a new regime for oil at some point here. And from a contrarian standpoint, I'm pretty excited.
It sure seems to be that way. I mean, from a long-term fundamental standpoint, you've done such a good job of laying out the long-term story in oil. And when you look at the distortion where commodities in general are undervalued, that's one of the reasons we rolled out our energy strategy about 3 months ago, because that's a long-term trend that I believe that you have to have some exposure to. And we wanted a piece where you could peel it out and focus on that area. You're not going to manage risk as much because there's going to be volatile. If we have a recession next year, prices could go down, but you don't want to be shaken out when it's so cheap relative to the long-term demand that's there. And I'm just blown away. Like, I'm kind of speechless. I don't know what to think about what Trump's doing with Venezuela at this point. You know, the only thing that makes sense for me, if I stand back from the view from 30,000 feet, is it's all about the oil. Is that what it seems to be for you? That what are we going to do? Go take over another country just so we can get access to their oil from a long-term standpoint? Is that what's taking place?
It's definitely about the oil. I mean, if you look at the history of interventions in the United States, we don't intervene in a country that doesn't have something like oil that we want, right? Just don't do it. And so Venezuela, I think, you know, China and Russia had started to make some pretty good inroads in there. So I think this might be as much about a hemispherical sort of like, this is our region, you know, and we're going to come back in and assert this stuff. Now, I'm old enough. This won't be my first regime change rodeo. They never turn out as planned. You know, it's going to be easy. We'll just get rid of this one bad guy and then watch how great everything's going to be. So there's that. And two, you know, remember, like, so we kicked Saddam out of Kuwait, and on the way out, the Iraqi troops, they just torched, like, they made a huge problem. They blew up all these oil wells. It turns out the oil infrastructure, refineries, pipelines, wells, pretty fragile stuff. So if we think we're just going to sort of waltz in and take all that over and get it up and running to our favor, there's a good chance it could get set back pretty severely, because wars tend to be explodey, you know, and things. It's very hard to squat on and steal energy resources. It's a hard thing to do. So might go as planned, probably won't, best guess.
Again, that's just another piece that, you know, another potential time bomb that's been placed in an already weakening economy, struggling consumer, maybe not the top 10%, those that own the assets, but we're in a very fragile situation with the overall economy, the markets, everything seems to have reached maximum efficiency. And that's the reason why, once you reach maximum efficiency, if you're not constantly repairing and updating and servicing, which we have not been, you got to stop the car for a period of time to change the oil in it. You know, we're just in a very precarious situation right now. And we're at peak hubris from the average investor, thinking that the Fed can bail us out. Trump thinks that he's going to be the answer to everything at this point. And this is a very precarious time.
Well, it is. And, you know, we'll see what happens with the upcoming elections, too. And I don't mention because I'm a political analyst of any sort, but it could well have some very large market implications if, you know, we get a divided House or Senate or both or whatever. It's easy to predict you're going to have stalemate on all kinds of things going forward at a time when you probably need some unity and pulling together. And if we're right, and these recessionary forces sort of collide on that moment, you'll have a paralyzed government at the same time that you have a real bursting of an economy whose recession has been forestalled for too many years, right? And then the Fed's going to do what they do, and they're going to print and print hard, which is why I think everybody's got to be super nimble right now. You have to head on a swivel, really try and understand where the puck is going to go in this story, because I just think it's going to be such a disruptive time. And I don't think we're the only ones to think that, or maybe I'm the only one to think that, because Gold is telling me that there are other people out there worried about counterparty risk, which is how I interpret Gold's rise at this point in time. It's a monetary asset that has this unique characteristic of not being somebody else's liability, provided you hold it.
And at the extremes, gold is, you know, they call it the everything hedge. So at the extreme, if we get an extreme currency crisis and hyperinflation ensues, gold is a good asset to own. If you have a deflationary crisis, gold is a good asset to own because you don't have to worry about the default risk on the other side. I mean, if we did have a true Great Depression deflationary crisis and the price of everything goes down by 70%, only those that are that have cash sitting on the side, only those that do not have counterparty risk on the other side are going to benefit from that. Because you've got these AI data companies, they're leveraged to the hilt. If what they can charge for their services are 50% below, they're not going to be able to service those debts. Even your utilities, something that we have to, you know, we need, we don't have to have it, but we need in today's society. Yeah, we do have to have it. I don't want to be without power for the next 10 years, right?
Me neither.
I mean, they have debt on their books. So if they're only able to charge 20 cents on the dollar because you have deflation from where they were, you've got that counterparty risk. And when I go back and look at 2007 and I talked to 2008, gold had this massive spike going into the summer of 2008. In hindsight, we realized that that was individuals, big investors worried about counterparty risk. And they wanted to have an asset that somebody can't default on the other side and lose that asset. Because if you've got a stock that's heavily in debt and they default on the backside, only the bondholders are the ones that may, depending upon what happens in the courts, right? We talked about last week, get a return of capital. Your stock investors don't have that extra benefit in there. So if the company goes bankrupt, that counterparty risk can cause you to lose that investment. This cycle has been kicked down the road for so long that there's individuals that have finally accumulated a decent amount. I mean, think if you entered the workforce 17 years ago, you didn't experience the decline. If you were younger, if you were late 20s, early 30s, maybe you lost a job, but you didn't have a massive amount of assets that were accumulated. Now you're mid 40s to early 50s. You've accumulated, if you've been disciplined in your saving, the largest amount of assets that you have, and you've been fully convinced by the propaganda that the Fed's going to be able to bail out the day and you don't have to worry about anything. I mean, this could be life-changing for the baby boomers. It could also be life-changing if we break into deflation. I do still think that we're going to have some deflation in the short term. And then the ultimate end game is inflation to severe inflation because of the Fed's activities.
Right. And so we'll know. So that's the deflation gets everybody scared, and it creates the political cover for the Fed to go, well, we have to think how bad this could get. We better print. So they need an excuse. So they use the cover of the deflationary bit to print more. And so what does printing more look like? It'll be $2,000 stimmy checks per person. It'll be $5,000 stimmy checks per person. It'll be a temporary tax holiday. It will be the elimination of the income tax. Just print it and you keep your money. There'll be all these efforts to go like that. But that's the starting pistol, Paul, for me, for that final inflationary run. And here's what happens. At first, you're like, wow, look at all this activity, right? And then the dust settles and you go, oh, the cut line, I need to earn $200,000 in income to not feel poor. And then the tax holiday happens and the dust settles. And then it's like, oh, I need $400,000 of income or I'm going to feel poor. And that's how it goes. And it always feels fun at first, and it's terrible later. I mean, this is like mixing beer, whiskey, and wine, you know, and then having to go to work at 4 a.m. Like, it just doesn't work out.
And that treadmill gets faster and faster and faster and faster and faster. And there's no, you know, the bad thing about the inflation is if you make a mistake, if you just make a normal mistake, your ability to recover from that is pretty much over, because that treadmill is going so fast that if you stumble, you get kicked off the treadmill. You know, the next person over there is just running as hard as they can, hoping that that doesn't happen to them. And you're left in the dust at this point. Yeah, you can get up and start running, but you're not going to be able to catch it on the other side. So we're forcing everybody to be speculators if we do that. And then even at that standpoint, there is the ultimate collapse at the end of the hyperinflationary regime because it can't go on forever. So it's just bringing misery upon the populace is what it's doing for short-term political gain. Because weak men and women do not have the strength to overcome their own pride and selfish desires and their desire to control for power. And that brings hard times upon the populace. And one of the things that's amazing to me is I'm watching Gen Z right now. Mm-hmm. They're rebelling against what's taking place. They understand they don't know what to do with it. That's how we end up with mandamis, right? But they understand that the path that we're on is unsustainable, and they're making different decisions. They're starting to make different decisions, and it's quite interesting to me because they're much more awake than anybody within the baby boomer generation realizes.
Yeah, no, that generational schism is getting very pronounced. I think the Venn diagrams don't touch anymore. The circles don't overlap. And you know, I was talking with somebody the other day, and they were like, "Oh, this Nick Fuentes kid who's brash and abrasive, and you know, I wouldn't choose his style whatsoever or say the things he does." They're like, "Oh, look, he's going to cause this outcome." I said, "No. He's the symptom.
No, yes.
The generation above him, the generations above him, were the cause. They created this." It's kind of like the generations above said, I got mine. They put a moat around the whole thing and pulled the drawbridge up and said, hey, Fed, keep printing so that I don't experience any loss around this. And so the people on the other side of that drawbridge, understandably, are like, I have no interest in helping you live a good life on your side of the moat. And that's where we're at. I see it as a moral failing at this point of the older generations, because it's my job to leave behind as good a world, if not a better world, than the one I came into. That's the deal.
Mm-hmm.
I think the deal's broken.
And I think the large majority just don't realize that it's broken because they've had the wind at their sails all the way through. You know, I have so many clients that are in the baby boomer generation. They're good-hearted people. They really care about their families and they care about the future. The disconnect is they're having a hard time, which is understandable, placing themselves in the shoes of the younger generation at this point. They're explaining, hey, if you do things the way I did and you do this, then you're going to be okay. We don't have the same environment now that the baby boomer generation had back then. Discipline and sacrifice really paid off. But at this point, with the cost of everything going up and wages having kept pace with asset price inflation, I mean, you know, and Mike Green's done a phenomenal job. And pick it apart all you want. I love the discussion that goes around it. But the reality is, in my experience of working with younger individuals that are trying to save, he's spot on in that 130, 140,000 range where that's the point where you're just kind of existing and you don't have the ability to save a tremendous amount of your earnings. I mean, that's mind boggling for somebody that's in the baby boomer generation, because they're thinking, man, if I was making $140,000 a year at that age, then I could have really made some headway. But your money purchased more back then. I mean, go back to 1965 at this point. 1965, you know, what is it, 700? I know you'll know this data without me pulling it up.
I'm pulling it up right now.
Ounces of silver?
Yep.
Okay. So what is, if you've got it pulled up, you can take that $1,000, which would be 2,000 Kennedy half dollars, and go to Walmart. You can buy $1,000 worth of stuff. That's the purchasing power of those Kennedy half dollars for $1,000 of fiat value. What's the metal content worth today, Chris?
So right now, it's a 47X on the face value. So if you had a single dollar of silver quarters, right, four silver quarters, $47.
$47.
So if you had five of those, which was the minimum wage back when we started all this printing craziness in the 70s, right, $1.25 in silver quarters, that's basically $60 right now. So I could imagine people earning $60 an hour could probably do okay. That would be the minimum wage, though. That was minimum wage back then. $1.25 minimum wage.
$1.25 was minimum wage, which if you relate it in the same purchasing power today. So what we would have to have happen is prices stay where they are, right? And then the minimum wage is $60, which means, you know, those that are more experienced can be making $120, $150 an hour from
that. And everything bumps up accordingly. Hamburgers, yes. Roof jobs, snow plowing, everything just sort of like scale it all up accordingly. Yep.
Right. But in you know, to put it in those terms, if prices were to stay where they are, because wages have fallen behind prices, if you could do that with prices staying the same, now the younger generation can go to making sacrifices and saving a little bit. They can still live a reasonable life, but they've got enough left over to where they can save some to invest for their future. There's few that's able to do it now, you know, unless you're a part of a family that has the ability to assist, even if you're making the right decisions. That can help you get catapulted in the next level, but you know, that's unfortunately the situation we find ourselves in at this point. And it all goes back to the Federal Reserve, the printing that they've done to paper this over, and it looks really good in the short run, and now we're starting to experience the pain. And if we do more of the same, that pain is just going to continue to get worse and worse and worse, and more demoralization of society.
The only thing I can think to do to fix this is to echo what Warren Buffett said, which is just put Congress on their own terms, right? Pay them federal minimum wage, make them have to get the same health care plans as everybody else, no insider trading, and if you take the country to war, your kids first. I mean, just you have to put the incentives at the decision level. Once you divorce incentives and decisions, you get wackadoodle stuff, which is where we're at. So that's the only thing I can think to fix this, is just put Congress on the same terms. And then you'll know when they say the federal minimum wage ought to be $7.25 an hour, they probably carefully thought that through.
Yeah, that would be the right thing to do. That would be the moral and ethical thing to do. It sure mm-hmm. would. But we cannot even get them to agree to vote term limits for themselves. I say let's put it on the national ballot and let the American people vote for the term limits instead of letting Congress vote for themselves.
I mean, all of this just comes back to the idea that we've had weak people, very weak people in leadership, very weak, morally weak, intellectually weak, all of that stuff. And as we saw from the governor from my fine state, that's all kinds of weakness on display there. And so that's going to create hard times. We're getting there. The question is, can we skate past the hard times? As you and I both know, that will take an act of God. It'd be a miracle at this point. Everything has to go perfectly, right? We have to achieve AGI, and somehow magically it creates its own solutions and, you know, nirvana results. The odds of that are stupidly low. So with that, I think, you know, everybody's got to understand where they are in this point. I'm interested in helping people not lose their wealth at this point, because I want them to have that wealth to be able to do what they can to help themselves, their families, their communities, the people around them. I think it's incumbent on people who have assets at this point in time to use them to better the world as much as they can. And I understand there's this fear. You want to hold on to them because, you know, we live in a scarcity environment, even though this is honestly one of the most abundant times to ever be alive as a human. But it's hard because you know that there's raccoons on the back end who are going to do everything they can to steal this nest egg of yours, either overtly by passing new tax laws or covertly by giving you lots of inflation that you can't control. Both are thefts, right? So I get it, but I think we're going to have to understand that, you know, grow what you can as responsibly as you can, but be ready to deploy it in ways that are helpful as much as possible. So I've been having these same conversations with my kids, so that's why it's kind of fresh on my mind. But they're talking about this, and their fellow compatriots are talking about this, that this is not, they see no hope for right. them and their friends to really get started on anything meaningful. So they just don't even bother trying.
And for those of you that are out there that are listening, take the time to have conversations and learn. You do have wisdom to pass down, but try to place yourself in their shoes and really listen to what they're going through. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, like you're having conversations with your kids, I'm having incredible conversations with my kids. You know, and I'm like, look, build your war chest now. Put yourself in a position when the calamity arrives. That's when, if you have capital available and you're in a position to take advantage of it, that's where real wealth is built. Real wealth is built in the midst of the destruction and calamity, and you position yourself to come out the other side correctly. So, you know, I don't know if you want to talk about it now, you know, kind of my concerns about where the market is and the risks. If this AI trade is over, kind of what we're seeing in the short run, we can do that another time if it's appropriate. But, you know, there's I'm on high alert. And here's the thing I have to tell the listeners out there, okay? Just because I'm on high alert doesn't mean that you need to go bury your investments and sell everything and go to the side. It's not a recommendation. Because earlier in the year, this time last year, I was wrong, okay? I thought that we were headed into a 2000 type market, you know, top. It looked like that was going to happen until Trump turned on the tariffs and then, you know, started the fiscal spending and everything that takes place. But that AI trade is what kicked this can down the road. And I know I've reminded people of this time and time again, but what you have to pay attention to is, and I'll share my screen here, is just mathematically, what's the downside if they don't navigate perfectly? Okay, so what I'm showing here is the S&P 500 price-to-earnings ratio chart. So the black solid line at the top is the S&P 500. And then these are percentage gaps that I have from the red dotted line. Now, the red dotted line is a S&P 500 price-to-earnings ratio of 20. So that's considered overvalued by all historical textbooks. Okay, so our gap right now is the largest that we've seen above what the most recent earnings have come out to be than what we've seen outside of the COVID gap when all that money was printed. So what does this tell us? If the AI theme is over, if that was the only thing that was driving this market, okay, just to get back to overvalued that red line, which we saw in late 2018, we were actually below it in 2014, but you can see we've touched that line several times. We touched it again in the 2022 pullback. Mm-hmm. That drops us to 44.50 on the S&P. Okay, so what, 67.48?
Like a 30% decline. 50.
Yeah, so that's 2,000 points divided by 67.48. My specific nature comes out. That's 34%. Okay, mm-hmm. 34%. Now, if we go back through history, there's a lot of times that we've stayed in that blue line there, okay, below it or close to it. So if this is an unusual cycle, what if we start selling off, okay, and these jobs don't come back as quick and we reach the end of the efficiency? This is assuming the earnings stay the same, just to get back to what's considered fair value. Okay, when you're in a fair value territory in the market, you don't have to manage risk as much because the downside is not quite as large. But that's 33.37 on the S&P. That's over a 50% decline. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, let's argue that the Fed will print enough money. There's no way that we could get back to undervalued. Okay, but if I go back up here and I look, We saw undervalued after the Great Depression. We saw undervalued during the 1950s. After stretching the upper end of that band, we saw undervalued in the 1970s. And guess what? We had a lot of inflation in 1970s. So you see those dotted lines, they rise. Corporate earnings went up, but profits were squeezed. So the valuations on the market came back to undervalued for a period of time. That laid the launch pad for the incredible growth that we had through the 80s and 90s. So that's a 22.25 on the S&P, okay? And that's hard to imagine that could happen, but it's just math. I mean, that's a 70% decline if we go down to 20.25 on the S&P. So, you know, then we go over here and we take a look. What's the S&P 500 doing? Now, I know there's a lot of lines on this chart, so y'all bear with me. This top line on the right here, that's what we call a resistance line, okay? So we tagged that level back in at the end of October. We sold off, and guess what? We hit this prior support line. So above the green is a support line. And so we're consolidating in this range. We just failed right here at that same level. So what that tells me, for whatever reason, they're investors who are choosing that level right now to sell. Okay, there are investors at this level right here are choosing to buy. In between is just a lot of noise. Now, I'm reading articles right now that the options expirations on Friday, that's setting the stage for a market melt up. Maybe that happens. Okay, if we break out of that up range, then we're probably going to have a stronger move in the market over the next 3 to 4 months. But we don't know what's going to happen until we get there. But we're seeing relative strength on the top that is weakening. That's a negative divergence. The price momentum oscillator, that's just the strength of the trend, is starting to decline. That's on the S&P 500. Now, there's levels of support. Maybe we hold here, or maybe we hold here. If we don't hold that level, then we're in a pretty deflationary environment, at least for asset prices. So that's the S&P 500. And then you take the NASDAQ. Okay, so you take the NASDAQ, we've got a negative trend line in price right now. So far, we're setting a lower high than what we saw back in October. Now, there is support in this area, and this is something that we're watching very, very closely. Does it mean that you try to speculate and determine exactly what the outcome is going to be and sell all your investments at this point? No, not necessarily. That's not what I'm doing. I'm going to act when we cross a decision point in the portfolio. But it's also the reason that I come to have talked about this from time and time again. Make sure you have an emergency fund, okay? Make sure you have an emergency fund. If we get this inflationary holocaust and we don't have deflation in the short run, yes, you're going to sacrifice some of the purchasing power for 12 months worth of expenses. I'm leaning towards 24 months right now because if we have a 35% decline and they're able to stop it there, now you've got some money that you can deploy. If we have a 50% decline and they can stop it there, if you lose your job, guess what? You're not going to have to go borrow money, or if you choose not to run a risk managed strategy, you're not forced to liquidate your investments at the worst time to pay your bills while you can't find a job. If we happen to go down 70%, okay, then there's probably going to be a lot of job losses. It's going to be a really negative environment. That 24 months worth of an emergency fund may be the one thing that helps you stay on the treadmill instead of getting kicked off and losing 10 years worth of gains. Because the worst thing that can happen is if you get into a calamity and you're forced to sell assets at the worst time because of forces outside your control and because you were not prudent enough to take the risk, you let greed take over. Now, I don't want to have 24 months worth of an emergency fund. It just gives you some freedom in the interim period. And I'm telling you, look, I've been through the 2000 to 2003 recession. It wasn't that bad. It was mostly in technology. Asset prices came down. But the 2007, 2008, that was life-changing for people that weren't prepared to weather the storm because they didn't have adequate emergency funds. They didn't have adequate savings. So, you know, look, we're going to act because I was concerned this time last year that we were running into a 2000 type top, but we didn't batten down the hatches. We waited for what our signals were telling us to do. Right now, I've not completely liquidated everything in the portfolio because we don't have enough information to do that. So if you're running a risk managed strategy, I can talk bearish. I can share the concerns with the listeners that are out there, but we're not going to act until we actually cross a line that is a decision point where I have a choice. Do I make this decision and adhere to this sell signal, or do I ignore it? If we were to price earnings ratio of 10 on the S&P and we're undervalued, I'm not managing risk. The downside is minimal. That's where you want to embrace that volatility. And yeah, still keep your emergency fund in there, but you want to embrace that volatility because your upside potential is so much greater than your downside risk. But I'm going to show this one more time just to point it out, just to beat this home. And y'all, please forgive me, but I mean, it matters, and it matters a lot. Okay. Right here, volatility can destroy you. Okay, if you're in the distribution phase in retirement and we have a 50% decline, let's just do the math on that, okay? I talked to one of my friends at major Wall Street firms, and they're telling people they're not spending enough at this point. In some circumstances, that's true. But I also had a client that came in. We ran the retirement plan, and I'm like, if you spend at the level that modern portfolio theory person is telling you, you got a 70% chance of running out of money by the time you're in your mid-80s. But if you got a $1 million portfolio and you're drawing 5% off of it, and you drop 50% and you're in the S&P, let's assume that's your only investment, it can earn 10% a year going forward for the rest of your life. And you're going to have to hope that it does, because all of a sudden your distributions are 10% of your account balance, because that $1 million is now worth 500. And if you had another decline on the other side of that, or if your growth was only 5% a year going forward because of having to wring out all of these excesses in the economy, then the picture that you had in retirement was all of a sudden over. So I'm not trying to use fear. I'm just trying to share wisdom with people out there. We're at a point in time that if they don't navigate this perfectly, the damage that can be done to people's vision of what their retirement will be is going to be life-changing, because you may not have time for it to come back, okay? If you invested on in 1929, guess what? 25 years later, the market came back to even. Okay, it took it 25 years before you got into positive growth. If you're 70, life expectancy in the U.S. is what, 87 for women and 85 or 86 for men. You don't have the time for that to recover. That's why traditional wisdom says that you need to lower your risk when you get there. Now, inflation can throw a wrench in that. But my point being is, I don't think you necessarily 60-40 portfolio is the answer, but you've got to figure out a way to deal with that risk and that potential downside, because it's a serious risk. It is a serious risk, and it's just math. It's just math.
Well, it is, and we've seen all the expected forward returns based on price earnings, and John Hussman talks about that. You've shown that chart. This was interesting. Apollo, Torsten Slok, who we've talked about with the double hump inflation potential, so he ran the same thing. The S&P forward PE ratio versus subsequent 10-year annualized returns. So where we are right now, we're at this red dot. For the next 10 years, based on all of history, you're expecting a negative return.
Correct.
Now, what I don't know if this is inflation adjusted or not, but if it's not, you have to strip out inflation off of that on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
The expected return, I think this is nominal, but I'm not positive. But if it is nominal, it's actually worse than it appears, because you're going to have inflation eroding that. You know, like that 1929 to 1954 example, let's imagine it's now 2036 and the stock market's gone nowhere. It's just sort of cycled along and it's just sort of gone flat. That's your expected flat return. Nothing much happened. But what has inflation done between, 2026 and 2036? Take a guess, So that's why you just have to have your eye on this ball, understand the context that we're in. This is a very unusual time. I don't want to say this time is different, because it really isn't. But we know what happens when governments overdo it and overspend and overprint. And we know what that means when stocks are this expensive. And that's the pieces we sort of have to plug together. And that's why I think having a risk managed approach and having and I mean truly managing the risk. So now we have to manage stuff we didn't expect to manage: counterparty risk, geopolitical risk, over expensive risk, herding risk, everybody herded into one spot, putting all of our money, on AI and what if that doesn't pan out, on and on. A lot of risks to manage these days, of course.
It is. It is. And it's funny because there's pre-great taking knowledge. David Rogers Webb, Chris, did a phenomenal webinar on that. I think, can people still go in and purchase that and listen to the webinar? Because that information is still relevant.
Yeah, and we're considering taking another run at it this year, because we think it's time to update that and go at it again. Such important information.
Okay. So, yeah, Carrie does the account openings, and once somebody becomes a client, she does the account openings. And she's like, I mark my time in pre-great taking and post-great taking information, because we have to open so many more accounts. But the reality is you have to take these risks into consideration. And then be prudent. That's what prudence is. So Proverbs tells us twice, the Bible twice, and I don't think it wastes space, okay? It's amazing what it gets in there. Twice, the prudent foresee danger and they hide themselves, while the simple pass on and are judged for it. I mean, how eloquently can you state the importance of being prudent? And simple means, that doesn't matter. I'm just going to ignore it. So what we do is we structure accounts as best we can to maximize SIPC insurance coverage. You've got to, do not be complacent with FDIC coverage that's out there. Make sure you're in a type one, which is a non-margin account, versus a type two, which is a margin account. And will that protect you? Hey, worst case scenario, it may not. And that's why you have a certain amount of your assets, like long-term insurance, that can be in metals. Now, I'd average into them at this point if I didn't have any, instead of just, panic purchasing those. Emotions can get you in trouble. Work your plan and your strategy. So, there are things that we have to do today that we shouldn't be doing. But we're far better in these type of environments when weak men and women rule, because they bring about hard times. It's much more important for us to be diligent, prudent, discerning, and do everything that we can prudently do to make sure we're in a position to weather the coming storm. We just don't know when it's coming. It's impossible to know when it's coming, but we do know that it's coming. Our history doesn't matter in the lessons that we've learned. And it's very foolish to ignore the lessons of history, because one thing I try to tell my kids is don't judge other people because you've not walked in their shoes, but watch other people, okay, and learn from somebody else's mistakes and learn history, because people get in the history books for making good decisions or making bad decisions, and good decisions can help us learn and bad decisions can help us learn. So learn from other people's mistakes, because you're going to make plenty of your own. And that's where we have to be right now. And that's what our job is to implement an adaptive tactical strategy, because there are a lot of undervalued assets out there right now. And there's going to come a time where you have to overweight those to protect yourself from potential inflationary outcome. We're also at a period of time where if they don't navigate this perfectly, you have to pay attention to the downside risk in the market, because all of history tells us that we have visited those levels time and time and time again. And we tend to visit them when very few people believe that it's possible to visit those levels. So be prudent. Don't be simple. And our job is to help make sure people are prudent and not simple, because you don't want to be judged for being simple and foolish in this environment.
Very well said. Paul, we're going to leave it there for today. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Hope you got a lot out of this conversation. We went a little longer than usual, but there was so much important stuff to talk about, and we will continue to talk about what's important, because these are really unusual times. If you want to talk to Paul and or his team and pursue a risk-managed portfolio strategy, it begins by going to peakfinancialinvesting.com. Filling out a simple form. Somebody will contact you from Paul's firm within 48 business hours to arrange one of what's hopefully three phone calls. An initial get to know you phone call. Then there's going to be a review of looking at what you've got. And then if it proceeds from there, it'll go to recommendations. I highly advise everybody go through the process, whether or not you end up working with Paul. It's an extraordinarily valuable service you provide. So thank you for doing that, Paul. And
thank you.
Yeah, have a great weekend.
It's our honor. You too, Chris. Look forward to our next conversation.